The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keffin. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, I shall be reading to you from the April 2020 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. We'll begin with an article titled The Comeback, text by Mark Jenkins. Long victimized by poaching and deforestation, Africa's mountain gorillas are in the midst of a surprising rebound that is sparking new hopes for the beloved primate. Mountain gorillas, today one of the most beloved wild animals on the planet, were little known 4 decades ago when the American primatologist Diane Fossey, commenting on a spate of brutal killings by poachers, warned that only around 220 of the animals were left. The mountain gorilla faces a grave danger of extinction, primarily because of the encroachments of native man upon its habitat, she wrote. Her 1983 book, Gorillas in the Mist, an affecting blend of field journal and memoir, and especially the 1988 feature movie of the same name, brought global attention to the animal's plight. By then, as all the world was shocked to learn, Fossey, too, had been murdered in her cabin in Karasoke, a research site in the Virunga Mountains of Rwanda. She would not be the last person to put her life on the line for this noble creature. In the past 20 years, more than 175 park rangers in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Virunga National Park, home to many of the world's mountain gorillas, have been killed in the line of duty, with 8 gunned down in 2018 and another killing last year. The park's director himself, Emmanuel de Merode, survived an attempted assassination in 2014, just hours after submitting a report of an illegal oil exploration in the park. Years after Fossey sounded the alarm, the killing of mountain gorillas continued. In 2007, Congolese mafia henchmen executed 7 of the animals, reportedly to discourage officials from enforcing bans on producing charcoal in the park. Brent Sherton's photograph of park rangers carrying the giant corpse of the silverback Senkewewe stunned the world, renewing speculation that the mountain gorillas might not have survived the rapaciousness of its primate cousin, Homo sapiens. And yet, despite a 20-year civil war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, that has killed millions of people, relentless poaching, and an exploding human population, the mountain gorilla is making an amazing comeback thanks to the selfless commitment of countless Africans. In 2008, field surveys estimated 680 mountain gorillas. Today, according to the most recent studies, there are 1,063. The new data prompted the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, to change the mountain gorilla status from critically endangered to endangered. These population survey results signal a real recovery, says Anna Bem Mazozera, director of the International Gorilla Conservation Program, IGCP, based in Rwanda. This doesn't mean we're in the clear. These are still very fragile populations, but the increase is incredibly encouraging. Living in cloud forests at 8,000 to 13,000 feet, mountain gorillas are entirely covered in long black fur, an adaptation to cold that distinguishes them from lowland gorillas. Their habitat is limited to just 300 square miles, divided between 2 locations. One is the Virunga mountain range, including the Makeno sector of Virunga National Park in DRC, Volcanoes National Park in Rwanda, and Magahinga Gorilla National Park in Uganda. The other habitat is located in the Bawindi Impenetrable National Park in Uganda and the contiguous Sarambwe Nature Reserve in DRC. Both locations, once heavily wooded, are now surrounded by intense agriculture and dense human populations. The mountain gorilla rebound is impressive in light of the animal's unhurried reproductive biology. Male gorillas reach adulthood at 12 to 15 years, and each social group of 5 to 40 individuals is led by a dominant silverback, a mature male, which lives up to 35 years. Females reach sexual maturity at 8 to 10 years. Gestation is typically 8.5 months, and a newborn is a mere 4 pounds. A baby nurses for 2 to 4 years. A female gives birth to one baby every 4 to 6 years. For these reasons, delayed maturity, long gestation, predominantly singleton births, and long intervals between births, mountain gorilla populations increase slowly. By comparison, a female lion has 1 to 6 cubs after a 4-month gestation, and full maturity requires only 3 to 4 years. One key to the gorilla population increase, says Bem Mazozera, is long-term high-level political support. In 2015, DRC, Rwanda, and Uganda signed the Greater Virunga Transboundary Collaboration, a treaty to foster conservation and develop tourism, including anti-poaching efforts, habitat protection, and wildlife surveys. There is serious political will in all three countries, says Mazozera, and governments as well as NGOs such as the World Wildlife Fund are also working together. Of course, gorillas don't care about legal agreements and national borders. One troop has migrated from the DRC to Rwanda, says Andrew Seguya, executive secretary of the Greater Virunga Transboundary Collaboration. Another troop has been moving back and forth across the border. The goal of the treaty was to create one landscape where all wildlife can find a home that is not limited by political boundaries. That the gorillas have responded so quickly is a reflection of the success of the treaty. But high-level diplomacy isn't the sole reason for success, or maybe even the main reason, Seguya says. What has really brought mountain gorillas back from the brink of extinction is community engagement and cooperation. Not long ago, people in communities adjacent to the parks tended to view the mountain gorillas as competitors. People were grazing cattle and hunting for bushmeat in the parks, and sometimes facilitated the capture of baby gorillas in exchange for cash. Protecting the gorillas meant protecting the parks, which seemed to threaten the livelihoods of local residents. A conservation initiative set to work raising awareness of the potential economic value of the mountain gorillas, especially to ecotourism. A gorilla guide could earn more than a gorilla poacher. Selling produce to a local lodge would bring in more money than hawking it on the street. Working as a manager in a hotel would pay better than herding cattle in the park. Education and real opportunities have completely flipped their understanding of the situation, Seguya says of the residents. IGCP's Bem Mazozera agrees. Village-level buy-in has been critical to the gorilla success story. People now feel heard by park officials. They partner with the park whenever an issue arises. 10 years ago, the question was, will mountain gorillas survive? Today the question is, how can we sustain, even increase, the current population? According to IGCP, there are a remarkable 45 gorilla groups that have now been habituated to tourism and research. 28 groups in Virunga National Park, 17 in Bawindi Sarambwe. Bem Mazozera says money, cash from regulated tourism, has been a great benefit to local and regional economies. A mountain gorilla tour is costly, approximately $1,500 in Rwanda, $700 in Uganda, and $400 in DRC. A significant share of the proceeds and park entry fees goes back to the villages. These revenues are being used to build schools, roads, cisterns, and other infrastructure. Better roads mean local farmers can more easily get their products to market, and kids can more easily get to school. Community members are being hired to serve as porters and guides for gorilla tours. A beneficial relationship has formed. When mountain gorillas prosper, so do communities. Most of the cattle have now been removed from the parks. Hunters have changed. Previously, they used snares to catch bushmeat, small antelope, and other game, but gorillas were sometimes caught, says Seguya. Many snares have been removed, and consequently, poaching has been reduced. Seguya says park rangers used to be the front line in protecting gorillas, but now this duty is shared with the villages. Because the residents are now working with us rather than against us, information about prohibited activities is passed on to authorities. Now the poachers, not the gorillas, threaten livelihoods. Other changes have arisen, though. Ecotourism itself is not without risk, because people can pass infectious diseases to mountain gorillas. As a result, visitors are asked to wear a surgical mask, keep at least 23 feet away from mountain gorillas, and limit visits to 1 hour. Anyone not wearing a mask must keep at least 32 feet away. Meanwhile, researchers also worry about the impact of climate change on the mountain gorilla habitat, which, according to one recent study, is likely to be in worse situation than it is currently if appropriate mitigation and adaptation are not implemented. Such measures would include ecosystem restoration, fire management, and water management for periods of both flood and drought. Finally, human conflicts in and around gorilla habitat pose a threat to the animals, particularly in DRC, a country in the midst of an interminable civil war. Poor people are drawn into insurgent militias for economic reasons, says Seguya. They just want a better life. But nobody wants to have the risk of a bullet hanging over their heads. Providing opportunities to otherwise desperate parkside communities, opportunities beyond criminality, insurgency, charcoal production, and endangered species trafficking, is our goal in eastern Congo. It might be too much to hope that the prospect of aiding mountain gorillas can pacify rebel groups in DRC. But stranger things have happened. Mountain gorillas have magic. People from around the world go to Africa specifically to see the magnificent animals. The experience is one of the most profound of their lives. It certainly was for me. Watching a mountain gorilla family, the first thing that strikes you is how human they are. The massive silverback crines and allows his kids to jump on him. Mothers nurse their infants, stroking their heads and grooming their hair. Adolescent males wrestle, screeching, laughing, and chasing each other. Over 98% of the DNA in human beings and gorillas is identical. In evolutionary terms, we are cousins. I once watched a female mountain gorilla spend hours trying to teach her infant how to walk. She held the little ape's arms and walked backward. I once witnessed an old silverback simply bare his impressive teeth to an intruder, a black back apparently on the hunt for a mate, and the younger gorilla immediately turned tail. The more time I spent with gorillas, the more I wondered about the meaning of being human. Although we greatly enjoy and repeatedly abuse our titular position at the top of the animal kingdom, human beings are often no more kind, caring, or generous than gorillas. Mother gorillas coddle and protect their babies just like humans. Silverbacks are exceptionally peaceful beasts, although terrifying, sometimes fatal, fights always over females are not unheard of. The gorilla is one of the most maligned animals in the world, Fossey wrote two generations ago, trying to dispel the King Kong myths. After more than 2,000 hours of direct observation, I can account for less than 5 minutes of what might be called aggressive behavior. Mountain gorillas would have been extinct by now if it weren't for humans. Then again, mountain gorillas, whose only natural predator is the leopard, would never have been threatened if it weren't for humans. The heartening rise in mountain gorilla numbers may be the most important ecological success story of our time. It has been based on collaboration rather than competition, on communication rather than isolation, on selfless commitment rather than selfish greed. In other words, it is based on a rather encouraging change or even evolution. Humans have been acting like gorillas. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Ship in the Ice. Text by Michelle Nijuis. Lethal temperatures, howling winds, polar bears. On a dangerous expedition, researchers have spent all winter in the Arctic to shed light on exactly how the world is changing. Few people would choose to be marooned on a vast expanse of sea ice at the onset of Arctic winter. But this past fall, Jesse Cremian was delighted to spend 9 weeks aboard a vessel that had been deliberately frozen into an ice cap near the top of the world. On Mondays, she wrapped herself in several layers, including a heavy-duty parka and bulky orange boots with super-insulated soles, and ventured into the polar darkness. Driving snowmobiles loaded with equipment, she and her fellow researchers, on alert for cracks and fissures, caravaned over the jagged surface of the ice. After setting up a tent as a partial shield against the wind and bitter cold, and wearing red filtered headlamps to avoid disturbing light-sensitive microbes. The researchers used a battery-powered drill fitted with a spinning circular blade and a 3-foot-long barrel to draw around 2 dozen cores out of the ice. For the next several hours, they carefully sliced the cores into sections, calling out precise measurements for Cremian to record. Outside the tent stood a guard armed with a rifle and a flare gun, scanning the horizon for approaching polar bears. Cremian, an atmospheric scientist at Colorado State University, is one of more than 300 researchers participating in a wildly ambitious, eye-wateringly expensive year-long expedition called MOSAIC, the Multidisciplinary Drifting Observatory, for the study of Arctic climate. The observatory in question is the expedition's research vessel, a German icebreaker called the Polarstern, which set sail from Norway last September. When the Polarstern reached Arctic waters, the researchers chose an ice floe that they believed was thick and sturdy enough to last through the summer, and they moored the ship to the floe and waited for the ice to freeze around it. The Polarstern and its floe are now indeed drifting across the Arctic Ocean, and if all goes well, they will continue to do so until the expedition ends in September 2020. The researchers hail from more than 70 institutions across 20 countries, and like the polar explorers of old, they are driven to understand one of the planet's grandest, most mysterious, and least hospitable regions. But this is an Arctic their predecessors would barely recognize, and that is precisely the point of the expedition. Over the past 3 decades, the extent of Arctic sea ice in September, at the end of the summer melt, has declined by 30%. Since 2002, the record low for summer ice has been broken 4 times, and several other recent years have come close to setting new records. Scientists believe this is in part because the dark ocean surface absorbs more heat from the sun than sea ice does, which is contributing to a worrisome feedback loop. Warming leads to melting ice, which leads to more warming, promising more and swifter melting in the future. Because the Arctic plays such an important role in cooling the planet, MOSAIC's goal is to understand how the ice, atmospheric, and ocean are interacting in a warming Arctic, and how those dynamics affect climate around the globe. One group of MOSAIC researchers is studying the currents that move seawater in and out of the Arctic, and how ocean temperatures affect atmospheric conditions as well as the freezing and melting of ice. Some are studying the cracks and gaps that form in the ice as temperatures warm. Others are gauging the levels of greenhouse gases in the ocean and atmosphere. MOSAIC researchers are also studying the tiny organisms that live on the ice and in the surrounding sea. And Cremian is especially interested in those life forms. During her time on the Polarstern, she studied microbes. In Arctic ice and seawater she collected, measuring the minuscule amounts of methane and other gases that microbes digest or produce during their life cycles. She also collected air samples to study how algae, bacteria, and other particles blown into the air act as nuclei for ice crystals in the atmosphere, seeding the formation of Arctic clouds, clouds that in turn affect the amounts of snow and sunlight that reach the sea ice. The work poses countless challenges. Fissures can form in the ice and block the way to established research sites, forcing the researchers to find alternative routes. The temperatures plummeted to 20 degrees below zero. In mid-November, a violent storm opened up a new crack between the Polarstern and its floe, knocking over a 100-foot meteorological tower and threatening to snap power cables. But spirits remained high, according to Cremian, sustained by the international camaraderie and even the occasional soccer game on ice. During long hours in the ice coring tent, Cremian would occasionally step outside and gaze at the moon or the stars and try to take in the vastness of the Arctic night. Sometimes the blowing snow would sparkle and you'd just be struck by the beauty of it all, she says. To know that you were one of the very few people who had ever seen that, who has ever stepped foot up there, it was awe-inspiring. In early January, Cremian flew home to Colorado, hauling an igloo cooler packed with samples of Arctic seawater, ice, and air. Over the coming months, she'll identify the bacteria, phytoplankton, and other microorganisms in her samples from their DNA. Then she'll mimic the process of cloud formation in her lab, watching to see which kind of microbes most readily seed clouds at sub-zero temperatures. Later, she'll repeat the process with samples brought back from the Polarstern during spring, summer, and fall, to observe how the makeup of the atmosphere changes as temperatures warm, the ice melts, and the microbes in the surface water are blown into the air. Eventually, she hopes to pin down the precise role microbes in the melting ice play in the formation of the clouds. It's a small piece of the puzzle, but it's a crucial one, she says. If we can better understand how clouds form, we can better understand how Arctic weather and climate is affected by different processes, and how those changes will affect all of us. And now I'll move on to an article from SmithsonianMag.com. The COVID-19 slowdown will show whether quieter seas help killer whales, by Christina Couch. With the help of a poop-sniffing dog, scientists are on the scent of a troubled species. Deborah Giles and her dog are on a mad search for floating poop, killer whale poop to be precise. Giles, a killer whale biologist at the University of Washington Center for Conservation Biology, is cruising the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a roughly 15-mile-wide inlet between Canada's Vancouver Island and Washington State. The coastal waterway is a hot spot for migrating killer whales. Lately, the waters have been calmer and quieter because of boating and border restrictions enacted in the wake of COVID-19. That is why Giles has brought her scat-tracking dog, Ebba, who will sniff the air as the boat cruises, then start licking her lips, whining, and barking as they get closer to killer whale excrement. These buoyant, information-rich fecal samples ready for collection. Giles wants to know if the hushed waters are helping whales relax. It's just such a novel situation where we just don't have people going out on their boats, she says. It's markedly different. The power of silence. Although it is a large-scale human tragedy, the COVID-19 pandemic also presents some researchers with an unprecedented opportunity to see how nature responds when human activity slows. This question is especially important for whales. Researchers already know that loud noises from human activities such as shipping, sonar use, and sea mining can cause major physiological and behavioral effects on whales. The noise can drown out echolocation pings necessary to find food and mates. It can damage inner ears and other organs and cause internal bleeding or even death. Some researchers have long suspected that human-produced noise impacts marine health much more than previously documented. This is their chance to get crucial data to support their case. But isolating the effects of noise is a difficult task. The standard metrics for tracking whale health, including population observation and sample collection, often can't explain how much noise contributes to physiological changes versus other factors like food availability, toxins, or climate change. Samuel K. Wasser, director of the Center for Conservation Biology, says the current situation is an exception. When heavily trafficked areas get quiet, researchers can gather data points collected in stiller waters to compare to the norm. Wasser has seen this happen firsthand. In 2001, he gathered fecal samples from endangered North Atlantic right whales in the Bay of Fundy, located off the coast of New Brunswick, Canada. Then the September 11th terrorist attacks happened. The subsequent travel ban stranded the research team and reduced ship traffic in the area. Armed with data gathered from the previous 2 years, the team, led by Rosalind Rowland from the New England Aquarium, compared post-9/11 samples to those collected before the attacks. They found that the overall 6 decibel reduction in low-frequency underwater noise was correlated with drops in stress hormones called glucocorticoids, which help regulate the boost of energy many mammals get in stressful times like predator encounters or periods of starvation. Difficult timing. Wasser now spearheads research that examines if similar patterns appear in different parts of the globe. Since 2007, Wasser and his research team, including Giles, have tracked endangered southern resident killer whales in the Pacific Northwest to figure out why it's so difficult for the species to reproduce. Up to 69% of pregnancies end in miscarriage or stillbirth, according to Wasser and Giles' previous research. However, the timing of COVID-related slowdown isn't ideal. In late May and early June, the beginning of the killer whale migration season, fish populations remained low because of factors like bycatch fishing and habitat disturbance. They're not here, Wasser says, and that's because there's no fish. Just a few years ago, the team would gather about 150 killer whale poop samples over a 4-month field season, but that number has dropped to about 30, making each sample of paramount importance. As Giles and Wasser track the remaining whales, David Barclay chases the sounds through the stillness. An acoustical oceanographer at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada, Barclay records the underwater soundscape through Ocean Networks Canada's matrix of submerged microphones, technically called hydrophones. anchored in the Northeast Pacific and the Salish Sea, where Washington State meets southern Canada. Barclay published results showing noise power levels in the Strait of Georgia, a waterway between Canada's Vancouver Island and the northwesternmost tip of the United States, were cut by almost half during the first 3 months of 2020 and found smaller reductions at field sites near Vancouver Island compared to the levels the previous year. We have this kind of information on a minuscule fraction of species that are alive in the marine habitat, Barclay says. You can kind of say we know a lot and we know nothing in terms of actual impacts of noise on animals. For example, one challenge in the field is knowing what sounds sea creatures can detect at all, says Anna Sarovic, a marine bioacoustician and associate professor at Texas A&M University, Galveston. Researchers know the exact frequencies a handful of marine mammals can sense, but no definitive information is available for the majority of whales and other apex predators. Efforts are underway to fill in those gaps. The International Quiet Ocean Experiment operates a wide range of projects collectively aimed at gaining a bigger picture view of sound distribution trends and effects on marine life. Temporary quiet periods provide opportunities to add those little vignettes, little stories and bits and pieces, Sarovic says. Well, that's all that we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. I'll continue that article about the effects of COVID-19 on killer whales next time. Be sure to listen. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.